This is Judaism Unbound, episode 77, Folk Judaism. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And Lex, after a long bunch of interviews, we are back with a discussion episode, and I'm really excited to jump into it because I think there's a lot to discuss. Before we do that, I just want to remind listeners, as we do when we start these discussion episodes, that there are a variety of ways that you can help us and you can help this podcast become more and more successful. And we really appreciate all of you who have already done that. And we appreciate those of you who will do it in the future. So the ways that you can help the most are, number one, you can provide financial support. That helps a tremendous amount. We can't do that without we can't do this without financial support. The way you can do that is to go to www.judaismunbound.com/donate. And there are all kinds of different ways that you can donate there, ranging from a one-time donation to a recurring donation through Patreon. And if you happen to know a Jewish foundation or anyone else who would like to provide us a larger amount of support, then please feel free to make those introductions. The second way that you can help is to donate non-monetarily. If you have skills and abilities that you may be in a better position to donate than money, we would greatly appreciate those. And just to give you a few examples, we could very much use folks that have skills in graphic design, that have skills in website making, in search engine optimization, all those kinds of things. We talked not too long ago about how we're trying to get transcripts done of all of our episodes, and we've already had some folks come forward and say that they could help in that project. And there are all kinds of other projects that we really would love to get going that we can't do just the two of us. So if there are ways in which you think you might have some skills to help us in that way, please let us know. The third way that you can help is to give us a good review or rating or both on iTunes. The way that the iTunes search algorithms work, the more reviews that we have, the more positive five-star ratings that we have, the more people will find our podcast and be able to listen to it as well. So if you're enjoying listening to this podcast, please do any of those things to help us connect more and more people to these ideas.
And by the way, one thing I'd mention is that multiple of our guests in the last few months that we've had on the show, our relationships began or were enhanced by notes that they sent to us, giving their own feedback, thoughts on episodes that we've had, things they love, things they wanted to push us on. And eventually that partially or entirely led to them coming on to the show.
Yeah, and that's a great segue to the way that I really wanted to open this episode, which is kind of the whole notion of the bottom-up approach in general, you know, and thinking about Judaism as a bottom-up endeavor rather than a top-down endeavor. And the basic idea that I wanted to kind of introduce as a framing for our discussion is the difference between elite religion versus folk religion. And I really want to talk about elite Judaism versus folk Judaism. And what that means is that there are two distinct approaches to, in this case, Judaism, that there is a, and by elite, we don't mean that they're the best. We mean that these are the folks who have positioned themselves either professionally or in terms of practice as saying that they believe themselves to be carrying forth a certain approach to this stuff that's based on a particular philosophy generally created by those who are, quote, in charge. And the alternative is folk Judaism or folk religion, which is basically the idea that there is always a history of people in any endeavor who are not doing things the way the folks who are in charge want them to do it. And actually, you know, we have evidence of this from the very beginning in the Bible. And that's why I think it's so valuable to go back to some of these stories. And we see that there are all these periods in the Bible where some new king comes into power and smashes all the local altars, which means that there were all these local altars and that the people were practicing yep. their religion. We want to call it Judaism or not. I mean, you know, again, the elite say that's not Judaism or Israelite religion, right? They were doing it wrong. But nevertheless, they were worshiping the same God. They might have also been worshiping a few other gods, you know, but they were worshiping the same God and they just had a different approach, right? Including the question of whether you could worship multiple gods. And I think that that story carries through all through history. And so when we have these conversations about what's happening to Judaism, I feel like the idea that I'm trying to put together here is that we're often having the conversation, even though we don't fully recognize it, that's what's happening to the Judaism that the folks in charge think is the right Judaism. But at least the way that I'm trying to do this and the way that I'm trying to think about what we're doing is, were looking at a version of folk Judaism and saying, how can we make that deeper? How can we make that more of a powerful experience for the Jewish folk by maybe drawing ideas from what has been the province of elite Judaism in the past and maybe drawing ideas from elsewhere? But you know, what I'm interested in is an education that sort of says, look, these are the elements of Judaism that really are resonating for people. How can we make them more resonant? You know, how can we make them more powerful? And so it becomes a kind of a bottom up growth and development, and also a bottom up education. And in the same way, you know, I kind of look at something like, you know, popular culture, and we see, wow, that is the way to connect with a lot of people. You know, Randy Zuckerberg talked about how Fiddler on the Roof is the most produced play in high schools in all of America, you know, even in very not Jewish kinds of areas. And so the question would be, how do you make sure that the popular culture that is being produced and that is so exciting and so viral is actually powerful and valuable?
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by the pop culture piece of this too, because it like mixes bottom up and top down, right? Because it's bottom up in the Jewish sense, in that most of the people that are behind portrayals of Jewish people and Jewish stuff in popular culture are not rabbis, are not centralized figures in Jewish life. But it's also a kind of top down in the sense that it's not Jewish, but it's being done by a set of people with the unique power to create something and then have immediately, you know, millions of people, maybe not always millions, but thousands of people connect with it. And it creates this incredibly powerful opportunity because of that combo, because you have people who are not coming at Judaism generally from this elite place, who still have the ability to put it out there to a ton of people. And they actually, not only are they representing what they see as Judaism, they're kind of creating it. Because if something is on the show Transparent or Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or New Girl or any of these shows that feature Judaism very prominently, and enough people, including Jews, watch it, that is going to influence how they understand their Jewishness or their Judaism. I do struggle because historically, when I've looked at portrayals of Judaism in pop culture, first off, it tends to be here's Representative Jew, the 65-year-old male rabbi with the beard, who is boringly speaking to a large, echoey room, generally a sanctuary, often in monotone. Like this is what the caricature is in so many shows. But then I look the last few decades, and I look at things like Transparent, where you've got a female rabbi who's a key character, you've got forms of Judaism and Jewishness and Jewish identity that are actually pretty complex and interesting being discussed. I look at Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, where the key character is the product of an interfaith relationship. I look at New Girl, where the key Jewish character marries somebody who's Hindu. Like, these are the folk of Judaism. These are the folk that we are talking about as a challenge or a problem, but are actually the vast majority of Jews, and they are being represented in a powerful way.
Yeah, but so then I think when we talk about education, right, it's I'm trying to figure out exactly how to articulate this, but I think that often it seems like the institutions in Jewish life that have taken on the task of Jewish education as their mission, often, not always, but often are essentially coming from the world of elite Judaism, meaning that they have a particular way of being Jewish that they think is the right way. And they're looking at the people as an opportunity to teach them this right way to think, this right way to be Jewish, etc. As opposed to, I am still seeking educational institutions, right? But I would like to position them in the world of folk Judaism and to say, what does it mean? Let's take as an example somebody who's creating popular culture, right? Who's creating a show like Transparent or like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or whatever that is already got a large audience. And I can imagine that there are some Jewish educators who look at that and say, I would like to be able to educate the creator of that show so that they will stop making X, Y, and Z mistakes, or so that they will stop portraying Judaism as something, for example, that approves of intermarriage. Don't they know that it's not the right thing, et cetera, et cetera, right? And that's an extreme version. Obviously, there's a lot of folks who don't necessarily care about the intermarriage piece, but would still say, oh, they didn't do Hanukkah correctly on the show or whatever. I'm not proving of ignorance, right? I mean, sometimes that happens and it's just because the person didn't bother to do their research or didn't know and it actually is a mispronunciation or they did say the wrong prayer or whatever, but not for a intentional reason, but just because they didn't think about it. But what I'm saying is that there's another approach that says, look, if the creators of those shows were more deeply immersed in Jewish content and thinking and whatever, then maybe their ideas would even be more radical, right? Because they're extremely creative people. And I want to know what that person would create. You know, I would like to know what Jill Soloway, for example, would want Judaism to be if she felt the license to fully develop it. You know, here she is creating a show that's really getting at the question of the gender binary and really, you know, questioning all these ways in which we think about gender. And she, by the way, that show happens to be quite good at raising some of these same questions about Judaism. But I would love to see it be even more challenging, even better, even more thought-provoking.
The realm of Judaism that I think of that often veers closest to this, and it's not a coincidence that both you and I have been shaped by this world, is Jewish camp. For those who don't know, Dan is very involved with Foundation for Jewish Camp annual programming. I was shaped by my experience at a Jewish camp. And it's not that every Jewish camp pulls this off perfectly, but I do think that what felt powerful to me, and I would never have been able to articulate this growing up, but when I went to camp, I knew that every year the Israel Day thing was going to be different from the previous year. The Maccabiah thing was going to be different from the things were going to change. There was going to be a set of shared observances, holidays, I guess you could call them, all sorts of stuff. And yet what it meant to become a successful camp counselor was not, oh, you like remember what programs were done 5 years ago, 7 years ago, and you can replicate them incredibly well. It was the whole point is that like we're gonna have a cabin night come up, and the counselors that are like most effective are gonna be the ones that are most creative and most outside the box. And I think that mindset, and part of why people talk about the magic of Jewish camp or whatever, I think that mindset is part of what results, because you emerge from this wanting to play with Judaism in various ways. Even if, like me, you went to a camp where Jewish education was not like an official daily part of our lives, but you still get this sense that Judaism is something that you play with. And Judaism is something that is yours to futz around with. And it's definitely not this idea that, oh, if I don't get everything perfectly right, then I've like committed a sin. If I could make a couple changes, you know, snap my fingers and a couple changes in Jewish education would happen overnight, I think one of them that I would make is that we would stop saying this thing that, sure, there are Jews doing lots of different things, but Judaism means X. And it specifically, like, I hear this all the time, even from progressive rabbis, that like, sure, you might think X about a political issue, or you might be, but Judaism stands for Y belief. Sure, you might be doing this on Shabbat, on Saturday, but Judaism advocates, Judaism stands for refraining from labor on Shabbat. And if you're doing something else, you're not, like, sure, you're Jewish still, but you're not doing Judaism. And I'm kind of getting done with that whole lens of thinking. I find it to be deeply harmful, because the message that sends to people is that they're not, whatever they're doing is not Judaism, unless it's the thing that is really elite Judaism, unless it's the thing that has been defined by a certain set of people as authentic. Most of the Judaisms that I personally connect to, and this is not universal to everyone, but most of the ones that I connect to are heretical in some way or another and would be defined by vast groups of people as not really Judaism, but just, you know, Lex, a Jew, doing some things and calling it Judaism. And I actually think that it's in our power, every single person's power, every single Jew's power, to create what Judaism is.
I actually appreciated something that Lila Corwin Berman said. She said something along the lines of, you know, Judaism has died many deaths before, right? Meaning that there have been previous Judaisms that at the time that they were dominant, right, at the time that they represented the elite Judaism, the elites would have said, if this dies, Judaism is dead in a way that I can't accept, right? And sure enough, those Judaisms died. And so from the perspective of, let's say, a priest in the Second Temple period, Judaism is dead. You know, that Judaism died 2,000 years ago. So the question then becomes, what are we talking about when we're talking about, you know, hoping that Judaism continues, right? So number one, I think it has something to do with continuing to access that storehouse of the past, or that library, as you say, right? That if there would be no more interest in accessing that stuff, then it would be really dead. And so somehow we're hoping that continues. To me, I've talked a lot about the time in which we currently live as a time of wandering. And I think that what happens in a period of wandering, or what should happen in a period of wandering, in my opinion, is that a lot of different experiments are tried. And what that means is, like you're saying, that there can't be any more statement of you're doing it wrong, right? Whether it's right or wrong is going to be defined, A, by whether it's taken up and a lot of people want to be part of it and it sort of keeps going and succeeds. You know, if you're right and dead, okay, whatever, you know, but that's, I don't really see the value of that. You know, and so it's going to somehow be defined as by success. Now, I think that what happens in the time of wandering naturally is that a couple of different things are going to succeed. And a lot of things are going to fail. And if some of the things that succeed are not really reconcilable with one another as the same thing anymore, then I think you get a schism. So for example, the way that the ultra-Orthodox are defining Judaism seems to be fundamentally irreconcilable with the way that liberal groups are defining Judaism. And this is in the world of the elites. I mean, I'm not even talking about the folk versus elite yet. And so the question becomes, realistically, looking forward, is it possible that the ultra-Orthodox world and the liberal Jewish world are going to remain a single people in 100 years?
Or are they still, are they even now one people? And I'm not asking that as a question that I'm asserting the answer is yes. I don't know. I think it's possibly yes and possibly no. I think it gets to like philosophical questions about what collectivity means and what it is to be part of like a people. Like it gets to all sorts of different ologies, and I'd want to have like eight different professors of different fields to like talk about this. But like at a certain point, I really do keep thinking back to Yehuda Kurtzer's B'nai B'rach test. Do I feel in a rich, deep way that I share something more with somebody in the ultra-Orthodox community of B'nai B'rach than I do with somebody on my block who has my political values, my even non-political ways of existing in the world, and is not Jewish? Like, I deeply struggle with that question. It's not a clear yes to me. It's not a clear no to me. But I think it's possible that some could argue effectively that we've already reached a place of not being one people.
Just to be really concrete about it, I think that when you now have a situation such as the ultra-Orthodox in Israel that A, only accept matrilineal descent in terms of defining if you're a Jew by birth, and B, reject, you know, 99% of rabbis as being authorized to conduct a conversion to Judaism in a way that they will accept, you fundamentally get to a place where there is almost, you know, unless somebody is willing to only convert with one of their approved rabbis, and, you know, everybody who even has, you know, a Jewish father, everybody will have to convert that way back to Judaism, you know, and even a lot of people who think in their mind they have a Jewish mother, but she converted in the wrong way, or, you know, her mother did or whatever. You know, you've gotten to a situation where so many Jews that we define as Jews are not defined by Jews as them. It's just not reconcilable anymore. So I think we're already there, right?
Yeah. And even what's funny to me, I mean, it's not funny. It's either, well, maybe it's funny, maybe it's tragic. I don't know. But like, what's interesting to me is that even some of the rabbis who are on that rejection list would say that some of the other rabbis on that rejection list, the conversions that they do, are not legitimate. Like, so even among the people that are being blacklisted for being like too liberal about this, there are some that would say that others are treif, are not kosher, are doing like we're at that level of fracture already. It's terrifying. Well, I mean, it's either terrifying to me or interesting, or I don't know. But
here's the way that I want to talk about it as being not terrifying but interesting, right? Which is that if we are absolutely committed to this idea that we have to be one people, then it's terrifying. If we accept that we are in a time of wandering, and that part of the definition of a time of wandering is fracture, then it just is what it is. Right. And I don't particularly. And so here's where we get to the content piece, because I personally don't appreciate the view of Judaism that those ultra-Orthodox groups have. I don't think it's correct. I don't think it's valuable. I don't like it. I don't want to be a part of it. Right. But I recognize that they have a right to explore Judaism in that way. And I just won't be a part of it. Right. And if that fractures off and they become something different from me, this is the B'nai B'rak test, right? Like, I'm okay with it. Right. Now the question becomes, okay, now let's look over in the world of folks who, you know, I do feel closer to, you know, right, who I would identify under the B'nai B'rak test as, you know, like, I do, all things being equal, I would like to remain in community with them. I like them. They're cool. They have a sort of relatively similar values to me. But I could also imagine that those groups will fracture too, because as we've talked about before, for example, right, I am looking for a Judaism that is deeply political, right? Now, I'm not asserting that that is the only legitimate form of Judaism, right? But I am asserting that the way that I look at the history of Judaism that I appreciate, it has been deeply political. So there is this way in which I'm not just saying that it's just a storehouse, right? There is a particular part that, yeah, it's just, I can accept that it's a storehouse, but I'm only interested in, you know, aisle two. And I just don't want to be part of a Jewish experiment if the idea that it is inherently political is not inherently part of that experiment, right? I don't want to be part of a sort of collective that says, hey, we can't agree on whether it's political or not, so let's just kind of take that off the table in terms of being one of the shared values. I'd be like, no, I'm not going to participate in that. And so that's where, you know, I start to see the world of, let's call it liberal Judaism, fracturing as well, because I know and I respect that there are people like Jane Eisner, for example, who Lila Corwin Berman talked about. She is the editor-in-chief of The Forward, and she wrote an article about how when she goes to synagogue, I think she wants to just be able to have a quiet and reflective period and not have politics. And what I would say about that is, A, I'm not interested, and B, I don't think it'll survive. But I recognize that she can try that out and people can try different things. So what I'm saying fundamentally, though, is like, again, one of the things that I'm trying to raise here is like, let's actually accept the idea that fracture is inevitable. Now, how would we start to think about it?
You said at a certain point that you accept the right of somebody to operate in sort of an apolitical, like the right of others who are not you to operate in an apolitical Jewish framework like Jane Eisner, et cetera. Where I was deeply moved by Lila Corwin Berman is I don't accept that. And it's not because I think that they are doing something unforgivable. It's that I don't think it exists. I think there is no such thing as somebody operating in an apolitical Jewish or religious framework at all. Because Jane Eisner, in desiring a frame that is not talking about actively Donald Trump or whatever political issues of the day are happening, that is a political decision. The decision to ignore a political issue is not a, it's not only a passive thing that is, that has effects on society. And when enough religious communities or broader communities decide not to speak about any issue, that means that there is not movement in any on that issue, and it's, and it foments the status quo, which in many situations has effects that I would argue are lowercase c conservative, and because I'm not conservative, I see those as having a negative effect on society. It's not only that I don't want to be in such a thing, it's that I actually don't think it exists. So when I'm in, when I'm entering Jewish spaces, what I'm thinking about is like, which political Judaism in, for me, Providence, Rhode Island, is most aligned or whatever with my political Judaism. Is it the political Judaism that is speaking out on progressive issues, on Donald Trump, on maybe Israel-Palestine stuff for me? Is it, well, like, is it for somebody else, the political community whose politics are to not talk about those things and create a big tent kind of space where lots of voices are involved? I am aware that many people, that is the political Judaism they choose, that is still political. And then there's, then there's the communities, although because of demographics, there are fewer of them, that their politics is like aligned largely with conservative values and often the Republican Party. And once again, I can't say personally that they are not Judaism, but they're certainly not mine. And all of those, from the ones who identify as political to those who identify as theoretically like apolitical or not talking about political issues, those are all political decisions.
So then the question is whether the value of a single peoplehood is fundamentally a conservative value in the way that you're framing it, right? Because if I am willing to give up any of my activities in order to be able to stay in community with these people, then the way that you're defining it, almost by definition, I'm choosing the conservative political act, because there's no such thing as a neutral political act or a neutral act.
I think that's a really fair way of putting it. I think that's part of why, I mean, the communities I see that are struggling the most with peoplehood, and I mean, literally that hosted that Wrestling with Peoplehood conference. I mean, the Reconstructionist movement self-identifies as progressive, as part of, and that includes on political questions and religious questions. And they are as aware as anybody that the political and the religious really do connect. And I think that's part of why a lot of people in that world are trying to figure out and wrestle with whether peoplehood is a value neutral or value negative concept. I haven't thought of it as starkly as you just put it, but I think that's fair.
So I think there's at least a couple of reasons why folks that are out there that are desperately clinging to the idea of maintaining ourselves as a single people are particularly interested in, beyond just the philosophical, which I think is part of it. And I appreciate that, right? Just people who just think it's a good thing. It's valuable. It hurts them on a deep level, the idea that we wouldn't be a single people anymore. I mean, that's in itself an idea that is worthy of thought and respect. But beyond that, I think that there's primarily two fears, and maybe this is a good time to transition into this question of like, what are some of the fears that seem to be animating a lot of the Jewish conversation in general? But at least on this question of peoplehood, the two fears seem to be, number one, that without a commitment to collectivity, we can't defend ourselves physically against the anti-Semites, you know, we can't defend Israel against its enemies, etc. And then the other fear is that without a critical mass, we can't afford economically to sustain the institutions that we need in order to keep Judaism alive and thriving. Yeah. And so that if we were to splinter into, let's say, 10 different types of Judaism that didn't have a sense of present-day collectivity, right, that recognized their shared history, but that didn't understand themselves to be the same community today, that none of them would be able to have enough money to sustain themselves, and none of them would have enough, let's say, power to defend themselves. How do you think about that?
I think it's right to recognize that both of those are real fears that people have. And I guess for me, the way I answer it is, I kind of want institutions occasionally to collapse and die. Like I was really affected by something I read a long time ago. I was involved with this thing called Jews in the Woods in college. And it's like, not calling it an institution is like kind of funny. It's never had staff or, and it just, it pops up whenever it pops up. Nobody owns the name. There were some people in the 90s that decided to go into the woods for a Shabbat and call the Jews in the Woods. There were a few people 5 years later that decided they were approximately replicating that in a similar way, and they used the name. Then my crew later in the 2000s, and somebody was quoted in an article about Jews in the Woods during one of these waves that it was active. And it could come back again, who knows? And they said, like, look, I don't want Jews in the Woods to have a yearly, there's a calendar moment and we like have to come together to do something. Like, I only want it to exist when people want it to exist, when people are starving or looking for this experience. Because if it starts to be that, like, oh, this is a thing that we're doing every year, like, it's just gonna like become boring, and you're gonna have a group of people. Sure, there will be the core group of people that come every year, and maybe they'll get something out of it, but like, it won't have that same spark, and it won't be as open to drastic kinds of shifts that come naturally when something dies for 5 years and then repops up. Because as Ari Kelman said, you can never fully replicate anything that we inherit as a ritual, as a tradition, he put it. And especially when there's like breaks put in, that becomes true even more. And I'm not sad about that.
You know, it's funny, a lot of times when we talk about some of this disruptive innovation type of stuff, a lot of times people will object. Like when we talk about Judaism on the internet, they'll look at Judaism on the internet right now and they'll be like, oh, you want that to be Judaism? It's so bad, you know? And I'm like, I totally agree with you that it's bad. The question is whether you see the potential that it could be good in the future.
Except for JudaismUnbound.com.
Yeah, I don't really think that it's all bad, but I'm just saying, even if I were to accept your claim that it's bad currently, or it's not good enough currently, the question is, can you see a trajectory in which it gets better and better so that it eventually gets to be good enough? And it seems pretty clear to me that if you look at the way the technology is evolving, and you also look at previous technologies and how they evolve, such as printing, the printing press, the idea of books, that you see how these technologies evolve and change the way that people interface with this stuff. So, like, just let's take Judaism as an example, right? The idea of Judaism being something that's primarily built around study and learning and intellectualism, that's only possible in a world of widely distributed printed books as a way to define it all. You could define an elite that way, but you could define any elite is defined as scholarly. Not anyone, but many of them are defined as scholarly. I mean, that's often the way that we define what elites do. But the idea that you could define the whole project of Judaism as fundamentally something that's about, you know, an intellectual endeavor is only possible when books are widely distributed, and when reading is, you know, when literacy is widely diffused. So,
or I think that's true, but the other possibility is that defining it as an intellectual endeavor is a move to make those who have access to the intellectual stuff the only ones who get to define it, and then what everybody else has to do is listen to them. And I think historically that's what people did before we did have these channels, and that's why people are so threatened.
Fair enough. But I mean, I think that what I'm trying to bring it around to is saying that one of the realities of the internet, as we are already starting to experience it, is that if something dies, it can easily be revived in 3 years from now when some guy on the internet comes across it and, you know, finds some way to distribute it widely, and a gathering comes about and whatever. You know, who knows, right? And we don't even know how these things are gonna go. But I think that it may be that the kind of attitude that you have about things like Jews in the Woods dying and coming back, which even as I listen to it, right, it feels sort of like generationally a little alien to me. I'm like, oh, that seems like a loss, you know? But maybe your way of thinking generationally about it is very much connected to a deeply appreciated sense of how knowledge works in this era. And those things go together in ways that, you know, some of us from Gen X and certainly boomers and older may not even fully be able to grasp.
Yeah, I totally think that's right. And I am, so when I think about these structures of elites and folk and the distance between them and all of this, like when I try to think about like how we could go about creating a Jewish world where folk Judaism starts to get elevated. I think some of it's going to happen naturally because of the internet, et cetera. But I also want to start, I want to talk about the word heretic. I want to talk about heretics in Jewish history and now, et cetera, because I actually think the structure of a heretic is super powerful. Because what a heretic is a clear recognition that somebody can do a whole lot of stuff theoretically, quote unquote, wrong, or actively dissent from the norms of a society, but they're not out. They're not kicked out of Judaism. They're a heretic. So like we have these paradigms of people in Jewish history. We have, you know, this guy in the Talmud, Elisha ben Abuya, who is a paradigmatic heretic. We have Baruch Spinoza, 1,500 years later, who is, he actually, by some, was literally excommunicated, but still was recognized and by many others as being, and is certainly today seen as somebody within the Jewish, maybe not the Jewish tradition, but within the history of Judaism. And he would certainly bring, like, I want to start looking at what it was about these people that was A, so threatening, and B, what was the positive, like, what did they bring that was really special? I think of the work that the book As a Driven Leaf did, which spotlights this guy, Elisha ben Abuya, and actually gives a very sympathetic read of his life straddling the rabbinic world and the Roman world and how he like deals with this. And I think of people who even went to like day school, were very in the elite circles, who now look at him through a much more sophisticated lens. I want to like grab all the heretics. I've been thinking lately about making like an alternative to the Pirkei Avot, at the beginning of the teachings of our fathers, that goes, and Moses passed down the teaching to Joshua, and Joshua's into the great assembly. I want to do like Korach, paradigmatic dissenter heretic from the Book of Numbers, passed down his tradition maybe to our friends from the Secret Book of Kings, to like Saul or somebody like that. I don't know. And they passed it down, you know, eventually to Elisha ben Abuya. He passed it down to Baruch Spinoza. He passed it down to Emma Goldman, Jewish anarchist in the early 20th century. Like, I want us to look at those people like, no, these were not just like dissenters from quote unquote Judaism. They are Jews. And like, when we read that section of the Torah about Moses and Aaron and Korach, it's not that Moses and Aaron were Judaism and Korach was the alternative to Judaism. They were all in it. And we today can actually gain positive insight from those figures that have been demonized at various points, who encourage us to really think expansively.
I think that it's really interesting to do that historically, and I'm really a big proponent of retelling our stories in ways that serve our needs today. But at the same time, the deeper question, the deeper impulse is to go back to that question of, you know, our chutzpah versus knowledge curve or whatever. We've talked about it in different ways. You know, the sense of authenticity, of value, that somebody can say, you know, I actually have a different idea. And what I want to be able to say to that person is, the fact that you have a different idea is itself traditional, right? Is itself a valuable way of being Jewish. And can we give you some language that you can use to make that case? Can we talk about that as folk Judaism? Can we talk about that as the hidden strand of Judaism? Could we talk, for example, about, you know, the divine feminine as like the you know, as the Da Vinci Code talks about in terms of Christianity having these two strands? You know, what are the different strands that Judaism has? And could we find a way to talk about what we're doing as actually amplifying one of the strands that has been kind of suppressed in the last century, often for very understandable reasons, such as the trauma of the Holocaust? That, of course, it makes sense that in response to the trauma of the Holocaust, some of the strands that might be more about defense and strength would be amplified. But now that that is not really working anymore for people to feel connected to Judaism, maybe it's time for one of the other strands to come forward. And I would love to find a way to talk about that so that people feel that they're heretics, but in a good way, right? That heretic is different from a person who is leaving, right? A heretic is staying and trying to fight for a different approach. And that is something that I want to approve of. I think it's an interesting place to conclude in a way with a question, because, you know, that comment sort of brings me back to Susan Katzmiller's conversation. And, you know, I'm trying to think about the folk question, too, of whether Christianity is in a uniquely sort of, quote, problematic position vis-a-vis Judaism than any other religion, right? Because it seems that, for example, the folk of Jews don't have any problem whatsoever in terms of looking at Eastern religion and saying, oh, I can be Jewish and I think that I think there's a question among the folk of whether you can be Jewish and Christian or not, you know, and I definitely think that we may be seeing to some extent that there are some who think that you can and some who think that you can't, and or there are elements of folk Christianity, such as an Easter bunny and a Christmas tree, that have nothing to do with Jesus, and in fact that have historically been looked down upon by the church, you know, that a lot of Jews in a sort of folk way are like, you know, yeah, we can have that, we can integrate that, and I guess I'm raising the question of whether Jews who look at that and object to it, right, are not recognizing that those elements are not actually Christianity, they're actually folk Christianity in the way that these same people would look at certain, you know, quote, Jewish things, look down upon them and say they're not really Jewish. And so I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably a question for another time. But, you know, I'm intrigued by this question of in the same way that there's elite Judaism and folk Judaism, there's also elite Christianity and folk Christianity. And there's probably elite Buddhism and folk Buddhism. And all these questions are, you know, to what extent are we really seeing sort of a merging of folk traditions versus a mixing and matching of elite traditions? And do we have different views upon all of that? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, what I would say to that is I do think that the Easter Bunny and the Christmas tree at this point are Christianity. I don't think they're just like, because what we're getting at is I think that just as in Judaism, this whole line between folk Judaism and elite Judaism, where we give preference to what the elites say and what the folk do, is not seen as genuine Judaism. Like, I would argue, and look, it's not my place to make that argument in Christianity, but like, from my perspective, based on how I analyze like what it means to be an ism or an anity, but like, when you have millions, tens of millions of people in this country and hundreds of millions around the world doing like having a Christmas tree in their house or engaging with an Easter bunny and doing so in a way that they think of as being connected to Christianity, I don't think we can say at this point that because it doesn't relate to Jesus that it's not Christianity. I think it gets tricky because Christianity thinks of itself a little different. I mean, people who are Christian often think of themselves differently than Jews do, and the question of belief looms larger to a lot of Christians, so that like what might be seen as Christian culture and Christian belief, like maybe there's more of a line there than Jewish culture and Jewish belief. I don't know. It's like a question for us to explore in the future. But what I would say on that front is, look, even if you're a Jew who thinks that you can't be Jewish and Christian, let's look at the last couple hundred years of American Jewish history. What do you think, like, why do we have congregations set up with pews in them? Why did we have congregations that, and still have some congregations that utilize organs? Why, even on the practical level of like the general situation of being in a shared space and mostly being quiet as opposed to all doing our loud Jewish prayer next to each other, like those are all elements of being in a Christian society and being shaped by what largely Protestant, but not always Protestant, also Catholic, et cetera, and in today's world, evangelical. Like, we are absolutely being shaped by those norms that are around us and which are often Christian. Even the language of interfaith, which we use in Jewish conversations now, faith is a concept that absolutely stems from Christianity. And I don't say that with any sort of malice. I think that there are ways that we as Jews have been shifted towards thinking about faith and belief more deeply than we once did. And that's positive in a lot of ways. And maybe it moves us away from other things. I don't know. But so I would really like, I think that the conversation about whether somebody can be Jewish and Christian, that's a conversation that I'm in a lot of the time. I mean, I agree with Susan Katz-Miller on that. I think more and more the answer is yes. But I acknowledge those who disagree. But like the question of whether Christianity is going to shape and continue to shape what happens in Jewish spaces or what how Jewish identifying people are living their lives, like that to me is a done deal. That's so straightforward that the answer is yes. Even as we can look at stats and say, you know, fewer Christians are going to church or whatever, like that's still that kind of influence is absolutely going to continue.
Yeah, it's interesting that the elements of some elements of Christianity were happily adopted by Judaism, certainly by Jewish elites, and I guess also by the Jewish folks, such as sitting in pews and having a sermon and whatever. And certain elements of Christianity have been causes of fear among the elites, for sure. You know, such as Christmas trees. And I think it's really interesting to sort of just hold that question. And I think that this is a framework that'll be very valuable for us to continue exploring as we go forward, and see if thinking about things this way both has an explanatory power that helps us understand some of the history of Judaism in America over the last 100, 150 years, and also a potentially creative power in the sense that it might open possibilities for us for the next 100, 150 years that we might not have been as open to had we only been looking at it from that elite perspective, which is the one that I think we've often been taught to look through. So I'm excited about continuing this conversation as we go on. And actually, the next few weeks, I think, are going to be particularly interesting on that front, because we're going to do a little bit of a dive into the experience of Jews going to Burning Man, which clearly is largely, I think, a folk behavior that is really meaningful to a lot of people. And I think that we're going to try to see if we can figure out whether that's really talking about something valuable that we should be thinking about going forward in terms of reimagining Judaism. So I'm excited to take that dive.
Yeah, me too. Some great guests coming up. And just to wrap up the episode, we want to encourage you, as we always do at the end of episodes, to be in touch with us. And there's a few ways that you can do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or whichever, lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And the last plug we like to make is that, as Dan mentioned at the top of the episode, you can always support us financially, and you can do that either through a one-time gift or a monthly recurring donation at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.